This is the Art of Darkness podcast with Kevin Kautzman
and Brad Kelly. We're a couple of very online writers interested in the dark side of what drives creative people to create against all odds.
This show is about art and the people who make it, what it costs them, and what it takes to bring something unique and impactful into the world.
Each episode, we excavate the life and work of an artist you might think you know.
Don't worry, they're all safely dead.
On every episode, we try and find out just what the hell was wrong with them and how they worked through their darkness to create something that lives on after them and continues to move culture.
Find us online at artofdarkpod.com and on Twitter at artofdarkpod.
Hey, we are back in the dark room. I am Brad Kelly. For people who this is their first dark room, how these work is we have previously done the core episode, the deep dive, the multi-hour investigation and exploration of a subject. And in the dark room, we bring on somebody who knows that subject a little better, a little differently than we do. And we kind of continue to develop our ideas, develop our understanding about that subject. In this case, the subject is the great poet Dante Alighieri. And our guest is the great Stephanie Leahy. For people who have been following along, she joined us for our landmark episode on Aleister Crowley. Big fan favorite. I know if you're listening to this, you probably heard that one, to be honest. Great episode. And Stephanie's a very good friend of the show and a great resource. Quickly, let me introduce her. Stephanie Leahy completed her PhD at University of Victoria, September 2021, with a dissertation on quantitative analysis of scrap parchment in medieval English manuscript codices. Now, we're going to see how this plays into the subject of Dante. I think it's going to be kind of interesting. She has been awarded both UVic's Gold Medal for Outstanding Doctoral Dissertation in the Humanities and the Canadian Society of Medievalists Boyle Dissertation Prize. And my understanding is this is coming out as a monograph from York Manuscript and Early Print Studies, if it hasn't already. And now, Stephanie, what are you doing right now?
Right now, I am sitting in, and thank you for that fantastic introduction. Sure. I didn't realize you were going to do that.
You wrote most of it already. I just found it.
right now, I'm the Cambridge University Library's Oshinsky Research Associate and Fellow of Girton College. So I'm a specialist in later medieval Western European manuscripts. I'm working on legal manuscripts right now. I've previously worked on parchment and will be working on parchment again in the future. And I also do a lot of cataloging for the rare books trade for auction houses and that sort of thing. I'm delighted to be here to talk about medieval textual production, historical transmission and reception of texts, and in particular of Dante's Divine Comedy.
We're super excited to talk to you. So, you know, I got a couple questions, and I know you've got stuff prepared, and we're going to get to that. But a couple of questions I do have. One reason this is interesting is living in, you know, the modern era. To us, a book is a book. They're kind of as objects. To be honest, they're kind of a dime a dozen. You know, you can go and find 20 different versions of the comedy on a used book site or buy them new. I think for a lot of people, they feel sort of interchangeable. But that has not always been the case. In fact, that's only maybe been the case in the last few years. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when you couldn't buy a book online. I remember the first book I bought online that showed up at my door. And it was like, this changes everything.
It really does. Right? Not only the what's in the local chapters or Barnes and Noble.
right. They made a huge difference. So, you know, so that's kind of where we're at now. One thing I'm curious to get your thoughts on. Why is Dante important?
Oh, gosh, we're getting a bit out of my wheelhouse here, because ironically,
okay,
I'm here to talk about, you know, sort of medieval textual production, like Dante's manuscripts and the transmission of things. I'm not a Dante scholar, and I'm not an Italianist. And I should give a caveat up front. I'm I'm hoping I don't infuriate Italianists. I don't know. I might have to go into hiding after this episode.
Are they known to be vindictive?
I don't think so. But, you know, I mean, he's important, right? Dante is regarded as, you know, because he's writing in the vernacular, and he writes this, you know, astonishing defense of the vernacular as well. So he's the founder of, in a way, he's regarded as the founder of Italian, of modern Italian, but also of a very important foundational European literary tradition. The comedy is a massively influential text and an extremely important one for a very long time. And it was right from the outset, from, you know, the time he wrote it, based on the extent, you know, copies. It comes down to us, his comedy, in approximately 600 full manuscript and another roughly 200 fragments or partially incomplete copies. They often contain one cantica. So you have over 800 total. And that is, I mean, that might not sound like much to a non-medievalist, but speaking as a medievalist, that is staggering. It is an enormous survival. It really is. This is the richest manuscript tradition that I know of for any medieval vernacular work. By comparison, you think of something like the Canterbury Tales, which I'm sure everyone listening will have heard of. We have, I think, about 80 manuscripts of that. Romain de la Rose, another important one. We've got about 200. And those were both very popular works. Mm-hmm. And those 800, that's only what survived, right? Okay. The wastage rate for the comedy, the percentage of copies that we can infer were produced but don't survive, you know, has been calculated around 80 to 90%. So okay. This is a runaway medieval bestseller right from the outset. It took right off.
Right. So that's this number of surviving manuscripts. This is indicative mm-hmm. of basically how many copies were made.
Yeah, it gives you a sense. It's certainly most of those produced will have been lost.
Sure.
Yeah. So that so many survive says something right. about this right. was produced in extraordinary numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. It might not only be how many were made, but also the kind of value that they had to the people who held them, perhaps, mm-hmm. I would think. Yeah, I mean, you know, I know in my book collection, there's certain books that if I lose them, I might not even notice. And there's others mm-hmm. that if they go missing, I'm gonna grieve for them.
right.
Yeah. So very, very interesting. What, you know, I know you've got some kind of notes prepared. Where do you think we should start in terms of talking about this as a manuscript? I'm fascinated by all this.
One of the interesting things here, I think, I mean, in the episode on Dante, you boys released back in the fall, you mentioned literary translation, right? This is an important ongoing concern. It is, definitely. And we keep having new translations put out of very modern works, but also very old works. And there's a great deal of discussion about them, sometimes very heated discussion, particularly on the Bird site.
Yes. You know? Yeah, we saw that with, the Odyssey? Last year? Yeah.
Highly conscious. People still, they care about these things, right?
I found that frankly heartening that people care.
Yes.
Right? Just, there can still be a heated debate with strong mm-hmm. feelings about this. That's actually a good sign, even if
it's
you didn't
encouraging.
Like the translation. Yeah.
Regardless of why they're arguing, at least they're arguing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Good, right? But I think maybe more questions crop up when you're dealing with a pre-modern text, right? First of all, how to approach it, as we saw with the whole Odyssey debate. But also, what if you're dealing with a text which survives in multiple copies and you want to translate it or you want to produce an edition? Mm-hmm. Which copy or copies do you choose to do that? What are you going to work with? Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes that's a really straightforward question to ask. If you're going to do Beowulf, well, I mean, there's one manuscript. That's it. You,
right.
Your pickings are slim. That's
right,
what you're
going to
do. Your main sort of issue there is previous or existing scholarship or translations and how you're going to be in dialogue with them and how you're going to handle them and the way you're going to distinguish yourself. Hmm. But in other cases, this is much more complicated than we might assume. It can even be really highly fraught. And the Commedia is definitely one of those cases. So why is that the case, right? How do we get from a writer sitting pen in hand in the 13th century to the paperback on your desk right now, which was one of many that you got to choose from? Did it matter which one you chose? How do we come about producing a text like that? What's the background here? And I'm mainly going to focus on the medieval sort of state of the field, what is out there. But yeah, it's, I'm hoping you'll find it interesting.
I'm going to definitely find it interesting. So yeah.
Okay. Well, I mentioned we have, the comedy has come down to us in about 600 full manuscripts, and then about another, I don't know, another couple hundred fragments of various length, right? Mm-hmm. None of them are autograph or holograph manuscripts. That is, none of them are copies known to have been written by Dante himself.
Okay.
In fact, it seems that nothing in Dante's own hand has survived, not even a legal document. So even if we had a holograph, we wouldn't know it.
Okay, right.
Right off the bat here, okay, we've got a little bit of a complication. We can't say, well, what did the author write? You know,
right.
What is Dante?
That would be the definitive, right? If we had that, it would sort of be like, well, if you see changes or mistakes, mm-hmm. you know, we go back to the root, but we don't even have the source.
We don't have the root, right? Yeah. So, you know, right in the early 15th century, there was an Italian humanist historian, a statesman, Leonardo Borini, and he claimed that he had seen Dante's handwriting. He described it as a thin, tall, and very correct. So it seems that something might have existed, at least into the 1400s, maybe, at least he thought something existed. I don't know. But to our knowledge, no examples of Dante's handwriting are currently extant. So you might then think, okay, if we can't go with an author's copy, what if we go with the best copy, right? Yeah. What's our best copy? Alas, of the hundreds of extant copies of the comedy, no two are identical.
Oh boy.
You see the issue here, right?
Right,
you want
right.
to publish this poem, or you want to translate it. Which copy or copies do you pick? They're all a little bit different. How are you going to come at this mass of material, which is at once all the same text, and yet they're all different?
Yeah.
Right?
It's
a thorny problem. And you might also be wondering, how on earth does this happen? How do we end up with hundreds of copies of a literary text, one which from the very outset people extolled, revered, and yet none of them are the same? How does that happen?
Well, it's before, I mean, for people, you know, who maybe don't totally understand the timeline, this is well before the printing press, right? None of this is mass produced. This is all, you know, after Dante writing this, this is, every copy is another person, or is it sometimes, I guess, a team of people
for sure
are sitting down and rewriting it in hand by hand.
Exactly. And that is one of the, as we're going to see, that gets very much to the crux of the matter, right? Mm-hmm. So Dante dies 1321. Now, the oldest securely dated manuscript of the Commedia is dated to 1336. It's called the Landiano manuscript. Okay, it's in Piacenza. So that's 15 years after he dies. Although there's another now in Florence that might actually be 2 years older, but experts are arguing about its dating. Right. So, but the Landiano is securely dated. And I have to apologize. I'm not a speaker of Italian. I'm undoubtedly going to mispronounce things here. And I beg the forgiveness of the Italian community.
You'll probably do better than we did. Yeah. Italian is a tricky one for both Kevin and I.
It is definitely. This manuscript, it's named for Ferdinando Landi, who bequeathed it to that library. And it closes out with an explicit, right? There's a little tag at the end explaining, you know, who copied it and where and when and why. And that reports that it was produced in 1336 for a fellow named Beccario Beccaria, and he was the Podesta of Genoa, right? Mm. So we know that's when this manuscript was produced. So between this securely dated manuscript and Dante's death, we have this gap of a decade and a half. And yet, all the evidence points to an explosion of interest in the comedy in this period. But there are no manuscripts from that time surviving. We have a proliferation of, we have commentaries, we have glosses on the poems, but no copies of the poem itself. So our sense of its transmission history must be indirect for that time period.
Right.
So we rely mainly early on various commentaries on the text that were composed. And they include, right away, Dante dies 1321. The next year, 1322, Jacopo, his younger son, writes a commentary, right? Then within a year or two, there's another fellow, Bagliolli. He was from Bologna. He writes a commentary on the Inferno. Some time between then, 1324 and 1328, a fellow named Lana, he's also from Bologna, he writes a commentary on the whole poem. Then prior to about 1333, a Carmelite named Guido da Pisa, he writes a Latin commentary on the Inferno. The next year, an anonymous Florentine writes a commentary on the entire poem. This is known as the Ottimo Commento. It's the highest, the best commentary.
Okay.
And then in addition to these, we have a bunch of smaller commentaries and glosses, mainly on the Inferno, but sometimes on the whole poem. And they span the period from about 1325 to 1326. Mm-hmm. Now, why am I listing all these? Why am I telling you about these commentaries? From them, we know that, first of all, the Commedia was being copied and circulated in this period. You're not writing commentaries on something that you haven't read or haven't even heard of, that's just not being disseminated, right? So we know it was copied, we know it was circulated. Mm-hmm. But we also know from what these commentators have to say that errors and variant readings had emerged. The text had already become corrupt.
We know this because of what they say in their commentary?
As what they say in their commentary. Yeah. Sometimes they complain about it, but they also, quote from it.
Right.
and there are differences, discrepancies, right? Mm-hmm. So the people writing these, they're aware already that this text is unstable and they're concerned about it. And the first documented corrupt reading, error or discrepancy we have is reported by Dante's son, Jacopo. He's writing only a year after his father's death. And that suggests that this process of textual degeneration, it probably predated Dante's death, at least for those portions of the poem that were already out circulating, right? Mm-hmm. We figure that the parts of the Inferno were out around 1314, Purgatorio within a year or two afterwards. And some scholars say that, maybe smaller groups of Canti or part of Canti were released earlier in batches. So he was putting this out piecemeal as he was composing it, right?
Okay, yeah.
Then about two decades after this initial commentary, Pietro, Dante's older son, he also writes a commentary, and he too points to a widely circulating error. And I'm going to focus on that one here to give you an example of what I'm talking about. This is a helpful one for us because it illustrates one of the reasons such errors persist, and also why, indirectly, why these commentaries and glosses are valuable, right? Mm-hmm. So in Inferno 24, we find a line that refers to someone who speaks and is moved, per many texts, mm-hmm. ad ira, to anger, mm-hmm. right? But Pietro tells us, no, that's wrong. That line should not be, it should not read ad ira, that is I-R-A, right, to anger. No, it's ad ire, I-R-E, that is, he's moved to go.
Oh. Right?
The speaker's not moved to anger, the speaker's moved to go.
Yeah, it's two very different things. Yeah.
Very different things. Yeah. Just changing one letter, you've completely mm-hmm. changed the meaning of that line. But you notice both these readings are plausible. Right? They both make sense.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems that copyists and readers and editors have. They're both plausible. So what's original? What did Dante actually write? Right. Was Pietro, 20 years after the fact, correct? Now, most scholars seem to be of the opinion that, yeah, he was correct. It is ad ire, to go, right? Mm-hmm. The person was moved and to go. Mm-hmm. And that's a better reading. However, this reading is not attested in any of the earliest extant manuscripts. We only know about it from his commentary.
Right. So this could just be, just because he's Dante's son doesn't mean he necessarily has some special authority about interpreting a specific line, right? I mean, yeah, he could definitely be wrong.
And yet, I mean, scholars have accepted it. And as I say, I'm not a Dante scholar.
Sure, so yeah. I can imagine in some circumstances there might be context which might help you decide, but that's not always going to be there necessarily, especially the comedy for all its for even for how long it is, it's fairly economical about how it is conveying action. And, you know, if I think about it in terms of a like a piece of prose, it's pretty economical. So it's not like Dante is going to repeat himself in the next line and give you another
reword it. So to make it exactly clear.
Yeah, he's just going to move on. So that could be very challenging to make a decision, I would think.
It is. And I mean, similar issues, similar, you know, instance of this kind, they crop up throughout all 14,233 lines of this poem, right? This phenomenon, these kinds of changes, this is often referred to as textual corruption, and it's not unique to the comedy. Mm-hmm. Works of some medieval authors, particularly those who are named, we know who they are, and they're writing in the later medieval era, they sometimes come to us in fairly static form, right? But much more frequently, medieval texts survive with significant textual variation. So different witnesses, that is different individual medieval manuscript copies of a text, will show discrepancies in spelling and in dialect features. And sometimes you'll see rearrangement or revision or replacement or even absence of portions of the text. And this can range from entire sections to individual words, as we've just seen in the era issue right. that Pietro pointed out to us, right? This kind of protean quality of medieval literary texts has been dubbed mouvance. It's a term coined in the 70s by a medievalist named Paul Zumthor.
Mouvance?
Mouvance, yeah. Mouvance. And the scholar is Zumthor. Zumthor.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Very cool.
So what causes this, right? When we get this kind of corruption, these discrepancies arising, all these different readings, because each version is called a reading, right? We get different readings in medieval copies of the Commedia and other texts. Now, one possibility is that we're dealing with authorial variants. Sometimes authors produce more than one version of a work. That was true then, it's true now. Mm-hmm. We don't have any evidence of this for the Commedia, although some scholars have suggested that there may have been variants, authorial variants. That's an hypothesis, so we don't have evidence for it. We don't have anything from Dante's hand.
Right.
But there are other sources of these discrepancies, and a big one is scribes. There are two things scribes do, you know, as surely as the rising and setting of the sun. They alter the substance of a text, and they alter linguistic form, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how? Multiple ways, all the ways, endless ways.
Right. Well, and I imagine sometimes those are errors, and sometimes that's the scribe making their own decision, I assume.
Bingo. Right.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's look at some of the ways this happens.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, first, as you mentioned, the outset, and yet these are all texts that are copied out by hand by people, right? And hands change over time. The study of you know, development and changes in medieval handwriting is called paleography. It's one of my areas of expertise. We struggle sometimes to read this stuff. Well, so did scribes. Some handwritings just also, you know, whether you know the script or not, it's illegible.
Right, sure. Handwriting.
You know, there may be damage to the page or something, and sometimes you just can't, you're struggling to read what's there, right? Mm-hmm. But also scribes made other types of just honest errors. We all do. And one quite common type of error is a phenomenon we term eye skip. So imagine yourself copying, right? You found something you really like in a book and you want to copy it out. Maybe you're keeping a commonplace book for yourself, or you just like the passage, I don't know. So you have this book from which you're copying. You look at the book, and that book is, you know, or document, that's termed your exemplar, right? The one you're using to copy from. You look at it, you get a few words or phrases in your mind. Then you turn to the page upon which you're writing and you write down those words. Then you glance back to your exemplar to see what comes next, because you're going to copy that, yes?
Makes sense. Yeah.
So to accomplish this, as you look back at the exemplar, you're not reading all through again. You need to quickly find your place in the text, or you're going to be there forever. So your eye seeks out a particular word or phrase in a certain area of the page to find your place, right? So you glance from the copy to the exemplar, copy back and forth, looking for the word you just copied, so you can pick up where you left off and keep going. And I think you know, this is a process from ear to mouth, even if you're copying a recipe, say.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
Right. But writers reuse words and phrases and names, and it's unavoidable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of frequent reuse may even be a stylistic choice, right? Especially in poetry. Mm-hmm. So when your eye, as you glance back and forth, jumps from one occurrence of a word to another, maybe it appears five times on the page, and you've written, copied down the occurrence too, then you look back, you're at another occurrence, right?
Right, right.
You don't realize that, and you keep copying, you have now introduced an error.
Right, right.
Error caused by eye skip. So maybe mm-hmm. you copied up to the word terra on line 14, and you glance back roughly the area of the page where you last looked, and your eye hits on terra again, so you pick up there, but you haven't consciously realized that terra occurs multiple times. You're on the wrong instance.
Right. Right. So you could lose a whole line or more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. But
now your copy mm-hmm. reproduces the text, maybe we'll say reliably, up to terra on line 14. And then it abruptly shifts to whatever follows terra, not on line 14, but line 15 or 12 or 20.
Oh boy.
So you've got a machine or repetition. You might look back to an earlier instance and not realize and repeat yourself. Mm-hmm. So it can be words, phrases, entire lines. This can happen. And we have specific terms for it. If you glance back and your eye, you know, inadvertently lands on an earlier occurrence, mm-hmm. you don't realize that you copy from there. So you copy part of the text twice. That's dittography. But if you land on a later occurrence, and you copy from there, omitting text in between, that's haplography.
Okay.
Both the forms of eye skip. They're surprisingly common. You've probably done it. I know I have and have.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I mean, I write by hand a fair amount. I don't do a lot of copying, but I do write by hand a fair amount. And I have weird little idiosyncratic glitches. Mm-hmm. One thing that I find myself doing all the time is if two words in a row share some letters in common, I will somehow smash them together. Like, what's an example? Like, if I were to write the theme, right? Mm-hmm. T-H-E-T-H-E-M-E, I might just write theme. Mm-hmm. And something in my brain says, well, you already wrote the.
So, yeah.
Right? It's yeah, there's some kind of consolidation that I'm doing at a somewhat subconscious level. And I read back, I'm like, what was it? What? Where did that word go that I need?
Yeah. It makes no sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So
I could definitely see a scribe doing that. I mean, there's a way this is sort of like, I don't mean to demean what the scribes did because it's such important work, but there is an aspect of it that's, it's a little bit like data entry, right?
Yes.
So you would see some of the same kind of issues that somebody who's plugging stuff into a spreadsheet all day might do, right? It's like everything's fine, and then you run into a problem, or you have eye skip, and suddenly the document isn't what it was intended to be.
Especially if you're copying for an extended period, I'm sure your eyes are glazing over. Sometimes they come to us in the margins of the manuscripts, right? Irish monastic scribes are particularly bad for this. They complain about parchment quality. They complain that they're hungover. They complain about the abbot. They complain they're tired and their back is cramped from copying all day.
Yeah, well, that stuff's got to be kind of delightful for you to find, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it makes it interesting. You feel like there's a real human being behind it. It seems kind of, yeah.
For sure. It's engaging, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is one kind of source of error we get, for sure. And But there are other types. Memory can be implicated. And as YouTube observed in your Dante Main episode, the comedy was so successful that there were people who learned parts of it by heart, and there are a couple well-known works by this fellow, Franco Sacchetti, and they depict two workers who are sort of speaking lines from Dante while they're working, and then they find themselves confronted by Dante, who's outraged because they make errors, right? This,
right.
You know, I don't come and use your tools and make a mess. Why are you out here making a mess of, you know, my work?
Right, right.
In like fashion, scribes can distort the text they're copying while, you know, relying on their innate recall of what they thought was accurate recall of the work or of similar turns from elsewhere in the text of his work. Or sometimes they might deliberately make a change. Well, you know, I know this copy I'm copying from says this, but I know this passage and that's not how it goes.
Oh, right.
Sort of thing that happens too.
Yeah.
So Scribes also do deliberately sometimes intervene in texts to improve them, to correct what they perceive as clear errors. But in the process, they might introduce errors of their own.
Sure, of course. Yeah. Well, and then there becomes what is exactly an error, especially when you don't have the original, what Dante actually put on the page. Maybe, you know, a scribe could have had access to a better copy, and they might know. That's a real challenge.
Yeah. Maybe their exemplar is wrong. I mean, there are some that, you know, we're fairly certain it was clear that they're wrong. So, for instance, you know, at one point, Dante he refers to the German theologian Albertus Magnus, and Dante gives his name as Alberto di Colonia. And, you know, one scribe writes his own as Alberto di Bologna. So, clearly, that's, you know, it's not Cologne. Come on.
Right, it's German. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right, and a list of ancient authors, you know, at one point, Dante has this unfamiliar name, Lino, right? Mm. It's a really obscure early writer. And in all but one of the early manuscripts, the scribes go, Lino, who's Lino? No, it must be Merlino, right? Mm. Then they change it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Huh. Yeah, they do make executive decisions when they copy sometimes.
Yeah, and I guess you would maybe... there's probably times where that's good, that they provide a kind of quality control, maybe, you know, stem off what could be an error that's copied over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, they're perceiving mistakes and then, you know, taking it upon themselves to correct them, you know, whether they might notice an eye skip mistake and fix it, right? Mm-hmm. This sort of thing, which can cause complications for researchers, certainly. But, you know, geography also plays a really important role. We have a relatively small number of Northern Italian copies of the comedy and a very large number of Tuscan ones. But the earliest copies are Northern, and that's probably not surprising. I mean, Dante lived in Verona and Ravenna for many years before he died. The Tuscan tradition seems to rise out of a specific copy of the poem that his son, Jacopo, assembled and is believed to have probably around 1325 taken to Florence. We know that he didn't have access to a master copy from his father, right? But he somehow had this other copy that he assembled and probably brought to Florence, sort of kicking off the Tuscan strain of producing these manuscripts. And so Dante's birthplace quickly became a kind of epicenter for producing copies of the comedy. I mean, there's one professional scribe supposedly provided dowries for all his daughters by copying out the entire poem 100 times, you know, getting paid for it. Good for him, right?
Sure.
Yeah, and that's fine. But what exactly was he copying, right? We don't actually know the precise form of language that Dante was using in the comedy. He was a native Florentine, and then he lived in northern Italy for 20 years. That's a long time.
Sure, yeah.
Right? To what extent did his dialect adapt, his spelling? Did certain features of his linguistic usage flatten out? Or did he pick up new features from the area? Did he lose vocabulary, acquire vocabulary, whether inadvertently or, oh, I don't know that word. Oh, it's a neat word. I like it. Right. I'm going to use like the sound of it.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong here. I mean, Dante is one of the earliest people to really be writing at least extensively in vernacular Italian. So I would assume that in some cases there's not really a source to reference to.
Yeah.
Not that he's necessarily inventing all of the words, but you know, just that there's no there might not even be sort of a dictionary, a consistent spelling.
Word, liking it and deciding it's going to use it. Well, a spelling is not standardized in medieval era.
Right.
You know, but even just different vocabulary, different, slightly different ways of conjugating verbs. I mean, even if the Tuscan copyists, you know, decide, say his language changed and he was writing the comedy differently, and they decide they're going to re-Tuscanize the language.
Yeah.
That language wouldn't necessarily be Dante's, right? The linguists assume that Dante's Florentine is the Florentine of the last decade of the Duecento, right? So it that predates the earliest surviving Tuscan manuscript. So the language itself has moved on, right? So even if they decide, well, we're going to change this, they're changing it to the language they're speaking, which is not the language he was speaking, right?
Right, right. So now you're changing what he actually wrote.
Right.
Okay.
If they did that.
Right. If they did that. Now, at what point does that become a translation then? Right. I mean, that's
And I don't know about the various dialects to say, but this isn't just a problem for us. As they copied medieval scribes, not just in Italy, not just dealing with the comedy, they would often adapt the text to conform to their own linguistic preferences and habits, right? Mm. So like a trivial modern example. So imagine me as a Canadian, I'm going to copy out a passage from your novel, House of Sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And as I do so, because I'm Canadian, I'm going to insert U's all over the place. I don't like color spelt C-O-L-O-R. It's going to be C-O-L-O-U-R and so on.
Mm-hmm,
I might do it deliberately. I might do it just out of habit. Mm-hmm. And we see this sort of thing with medieval scribes, right? That they look at the page and they kind of know what it means, but they're writing their own language instead of strictly copying letter by letter, right? Now, as I'm sure I haven't said explicitly, but I think we all know, in Dante's Italy, people spoke not a single standard Italian, but numerous very distinctive dialects. And scribes generally copied in conformity with one variety or another. So, for instance, and here I'm relying on Prue Shaw's work on the transmission of the comedy. There is a northern manuscript known as the Urbanate manuscript. It's so called because it was commissioned by Federico de Montefeltro, and it was in the library of the Dukes of Urbino.
Yeah.
Now, this manuscript opens not nel mezzo, M-E-Z-Z-O, and forgive me, Italians, for the pronunciation. But nel meggio, M-E-G-G-I-O. That's the northern form of mezzo.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So if a Tuscan scribe took that copy as his exemplar, so this is a text from which he's going to copy, they'd probably write nel mezzo, even though the exemplar reads meggio. They're going to correct to their own variety as they go.
Right.
This is really widespread. We see a lot in England too. And this can be really helpful to people like me, modern scholars and catalogers of medieval books. Those kind of details, they're among the fine features of a manuscript that we use to localize it, to determine where it was made or at least give a sense of, where the scribe was from. There are other features.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I wasn't even thinking of, I'm only thinking about how do you get the right version of the text, but there's all kinds of other stuff you're trying to learn from the object, right? Yeah, interesting.
Okay, well, where is this from? Where is it, So now sometimes scribes do this inconsistently, right? And that causes confusion for us, but it also causes confusion for them. If they're copying from an exemplar in a less familiar dialect, or an exemplar that's particularly unfixed or inconsistent, maybe it's a copy of a copy and some forms have been altered, but others haven't. Or again, if they're struggling with the paleography, the handwriting, a scribe might misinterpret what they're seeing on the page. So for instance, in some northern manuscripts, the present tense verb vedi, you see, is given as vidi, so V-E-D-I to V-I-D-I. It's a form which a Tuscan understands to be past tense, I saw, but if you're up north, it means you see.
Oh, yeah, that's so, that could be a huge difference, really, in terms of meaning.
Right? You're copying this out. Okay. Now the meaning of the text is different for you. How are you going to react to that? What kind of changes are you going to make? Are you going to standardize that? You realize what it is and standardize it? Or are you going to let it stand and then someone else comes along and thinks the text is something different than it is? Even manuscripts copied in Western versus Eastern Tuscany can differ in this way, in quite non-trivial ways that impact the sense of the text and how scribes are going to respond to it.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. And you can see, and just like our example earlier with anger and to go, was Ira, basically Ira and Irie.
Yeah, I-R-A, I-R-E.
Yeah, you can see, subtle changes there, but geez, you compound these a few times, and you can really affect the overall meaning of a
You can
poem.
change the meaning of the passage. And even the earliest copyists clearly were aware of the issues. There's this one scribe, he was copying around 1330 or 1391, you know, about 9-10 years after Dante's death, 6 years before our earliest surviving manuscript. And he tells us about the care he took to identify the best readings. He consults several manuscripts, and he writes, you know, on account of the lack of skill and experience of those who write in the vernacular, the book is much disfigured by corrupt and false readings. But I, drawing on various other copies, rejecting readings that are false and bringing together those that are true or seem suited to the meaning, faithfully executed this copy as soberly as I could. So he's showing here, he's really keenly aware of this phenomenon of textual corruption, and he's taking efforts to mitigate it. And this is the earliest known copyist of the comedy, right? Oh, wow. Our knowledge of him is indirect because his copy doesn't survive, you know, but he's...
We just have this note he has about the process of copying.
Right? Yeah. Already he's editing. He's weighing different readings. He's on a hunt for the right version. That this statement, it was appended to a copy which doesn't survive, but fortunately, Luca Martini, he was a Florentine humanist, and he carefully collated it in 1548. He had a copy of the 1515 Aldine printed edition of the comedy, and he had access to this manuscript. And in his printed edition, he went in the margins and he recorded all the readings where this manuscript diverged from his printed version. Mm-hmm. And he also, at the very end of the volume, he copied in that scribe's statement into his printed volume. So that's how we know, right? I've written down in the margins all the different, you know, discrepancies between this manuscript and my copy, and here's what the scribe has to say about his copy. He's really worked to produce a good copy. It might be the right one, so I'm going to take note of the differences, right? And an Aldine, for those unfamiliar with the term, it refers to a book produced by the press that was established by the humanist scholar and printer Aldus Manutius. So refer to them shorthand as Aldines. Already we have, right from our first known copyist of the comedy, we have someone editing it, someone who's aware there are errors and wants to fix them.
That's absolutely fascinating. I mean, it does suggest this conversation, it refreshes for me, and this is in part why I was so excited to have this conversation. I think it reinforces how much effort has gone in over the years, from Dante's time to now, to just keep this thing alive, even with corruptions and degradations here and there, and perhaps this scribe making an incorrect choice or making an error and that surviving. Just it's kind of amazing, really, the lengths that we've gone to as a civilization to keep this book and many others, obviously, but to keep the comedy alive. I think it could be easy to focus on the come away with this with a negative opinion of like, oh, you know, all these books, they end up being corrupted anyway, and there's no sort of true source. But I'm sort of seeing this from this positive angle, like, well, look at how hard everybody tried.
They tried so hard.
They really did.
I mean, it's a very complicated process trying to do is trying to make sense. Even now, I mean, to step back from these specifics, these details slightly, we can conceptualize copying, or we can model it as, this is, you can think of it as vertical transmission, right? So there's this existing copy, you make a copy of it, and then a copy is made from that copy, and so on, right? So in theory, this creates this like string, this stream of copies that lead back to an original, whether it survives or not, right? It's like a line of descent, right? Who is your mother and her mother and her mother and her mother? But since the copyists inevitably introduce errors, right? I mean, on the one hand, if you're interested in a pure text, that's a problem. But people like me, researchers, you know, and better scholars than me, certainly, which is probably most scholars, can track those errors and build what's known as a stemma. And this is kind of like a genealogical structure, right, of manuscripts, showing their relationships to each other based on errors that are shared or newly introduced, right? Because a scribe copies what's there. If the errors are reproduced and then there's another new one, right? The idea is you can look at the compounding of the errors and get a sense of how these things are related to each other.
Sure. And you can probably see if you can probably get a sense if, for example, two manuscripts were using the same exemplar or different copies of the same exemplar.
Yeah, that's the theory. Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Now, the errors used for that kind of purpose, they need to be significant. This is where things get so the multitude of very tiny errors that copyists introduce is termed a convergent error. They're not regarded as particularly strong evidence. So researchers who investigate textual transmission via stemmatic methodology, which is not me, I would say I'm a cataloger and I'm a materially focused researcher, really, but they need to decide which errors are sufficiently significant that they provide a really solid grounding to make deductions.
Sure, that makes sense. Because sometimes there's just common types of errors.
However, there is zero consensus about what is a significant error.
Of course not. Yeah.
Right. Also, I mean, this type of vertical model is compromised, and this is a big issue with the comedy, by horizontal transmission. So people will look laterally to other copies and take material out of them, and so introduce differences, contamination that way, by using sources aside from their chief exemplar. So they've got a chief exemplar, and then they're pulling in bits from other exemplars that they don't like as much, right?
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
Other manuscripts, because they want a best version. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
So this really subverts this deceptively simple model of a vertical transmission, right?
Sure. Well, and then, and I don't mean to throw you off track here, but then you get into translation.
Uh-huh.
Translating it out of the original language and into a variety of other languages, and that introduces it feel like a whole nother set of complications, because which version do you use to translate? You probably, if you're being a rigorous translator, somebody who's trying to translate something like the comedy, you're probably looking at, I would assume, multiple versions of the original, in quotes.
I don't have any training in translation, but I mean, I would assume so, especially when you're getting into more scholarly translation. But I can't even, the complexity of creating an edition as it stands is one thing, but then adding on top of that the other dimension of translation, especially when you have a textual tradition where contamination is utterly rampant, as it is with the comedy, from the very earliest times. Now you have an exceedingly complex picture here that you've got to grapple with. You know, and there's an irony in it, though, a kind of paradox, because right from the outset of the manuscript tradition of the comedy, you have people determined to, they're passionate about preserving the perfect, the best possible version of the comedy. And in the process, their efforts have actually made it really hard to establish an authoritative text, because they keep messing with it.
Right. Well, I feel like there's a perspective to have on a work like that. Now that I have a little bit better sense of the complicated issues about it, even just surviving, you know, we kind of set this up like, how does it get to on your desk right now in a new copy? I'm coming to appreciate the sort of metatext of the thing, that it's really like a phenomena with various different versions, obviously, and all these little subtleties, and the kind of history that comes with that aspect of it. This is what's so interesting about your discipline to me is, you know, on this show, we focus on, you know, what does the text say? And to us, the editions, and they don't matter a whole lot, really.
Yeah.
But it's certainly significant in all the things that you can learn about the book, what it meant to people, how it was distributed, all of these things. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, to look at, especially for very early texts like this. I mean, the situation changes when you know, the more modern you get, although I guess that depends on the author. There are plenty of authors who, God, I mean, having looked at some of Joyce's manuscripts. I can't even imagine. Well,
my understanding, he was scribbling right? in the margins, like as it went to the printer. So, I'm
and
sure there was
after.
Right. I'm sure there was transcription errors in that case. Anytime you get into writing by hand, well, mm-hmm. and not just by hand, but anytime you get writing by hand, I think you're introducing complications. I noticed this in myself. If I do a lot of hand revising and then retyping mm-hmm. in, and I've come into stuff that's I wrote it a few days before, and I'm coming like, what the heck? What does this mean?
Yeah, you think letter by letter. Well, especially with someone with like Joyce. I mean, is it an error or no? Did he really mean that?
Well, that's the real challenge. Exactly. With somebody like Joyce, it's like there aren't. He certainly made errors, as everybody does, mm-hmm. right? And so, how would you even go about?
Glory in them. Yeah.
How would you go about fixing any? Trying to fix Joyce makes me think of I'm sure you've seen it. It was a few years ago. There was a sort of a meme photo of somebody restoring a painting. You probably know what I'm talking about. It's very like, and they basically just flattened it out completely. That's to me is like if you tried to if someone tried to fix Joyce or somebody like that.
Definitely. I mean, the complexity and the sheer confusion of it is really part of the beauty.
right. Yeah. Absolutely. So I guess kind of winding down here. One thing I was kind of curious about, and perhaps we kind of got to it already. I got thinking about the comedy, and I guess just other. Maybe we can just speak in real generalities for a second mm-hmm. about the medieval sort of the act of reading. I mean. What kind of just broad strokes? I mean, how many people were even reading to begin with, or were able to read?
This is a whole.
I'm sure that I know this is probably too general than you're comfortable with.
Well, it's getting a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but also it's a difficult question. It's really hard to know, and also how are you defining reading? Right, literacy is a different kind of thing, right? And you will have different types of literacies for different purposes. You know, when you look in the medieval era and they speak of someone being literate, you know, what they really mean is they can read Latin,
right?
You know, but then there are other people, of course, who will be able to read the vernacular in varying degrees. Maybe you have a little bit, you have a little primer and you can read your prayers or whatever a bit, mm-hmm. You know, and maybe you can handle some accounts and things like that, but might not be able to make your way through something like the comedy, which is, you know, Dante is a very, from what I gather, is a very difficult, very complex writer. He's hard to grapple with.
It is.
Right? I can imagine plenty of people who, even if they were native speakers of Italian, and maybe, I don't know, they could engage with Mercantile Records or the sort, might not be able to handle something like Dante.
Sure.
So how are you defining reading? Right. And also sometimes you can, if you recognize the shape of words, you know what it says, but maybe is that reading, right? How are you defining?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. Even now in literacy, I think they sort of, at least I've heard it described in America, they sort of define sort of levels of literacy. And one of them is like, can you read and understand a medical prescription?
Yeah.
I think, well, geez, that's a pretty low bar. I mean, you know, if somebody can't do that, I sort of feel bad for them, but that doesn't seem like a very useful metric in some ways.
Kind of basic functional literacy.
Right. So I imagine similarly then there must have been a lot of people, as you're saying, sort of like that, who wouldn't really be able to work with the comedy necessarily, though they might have some ability
to read.
Have a basic
kind of functional literacy, but that doesn't mean that texts are out of reach for them, because, you know, and one of the problems here is that it's hard to get evidence of who is reading. People are, you know, not tracking this sort of thing. We don't have sociologists running around, you know, medieval Lombardy or whatever, and whether they can read and what they can read. But we do know that people reading could often be a communal activity as well. So people might read aloud. So maybe you know someone who's a little more literate and they're reading to you.
Right.
So, I mean, does that count? Wow. If you're thinking of reading, if you're conceptualizing and just kind of accessing a text, as opposed to parsing it yourself, right?
It's different, but it is still, you would be familiar with the text, right? You would know what it's about. You would know some of the issues it deals with.
How does this differ from if someone has a print disability and is using audiobooks and we say they're reading?
Right. Yeah, it seems to be a very similar thing, right?
In some ways, it's a very similar thing, right? So it's hard to say, you know, it depends on what you understand. We don't have a lot of evidence, but also what do you understand reading to be and which languages and which contexts, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly, we have, at least based on the report, and I mean, you have to take these things with a grain of salt, at least some people, Cartwright and things that were familiar enough with Dante that they're quoting, misquoting sections of it on the street.
Right.
a kind of accessing of the text, right? And I mean, you know, when I talk about the production of the rates of production of these manuscripts, and I mean, not all, we've talked about contamination too, but not all the earliest copies are contaminated. And there are three exemplars in particular that are regarded as relatively, you know, free of contamination, but most of the early ones, they do have issues. And yet we have this massive production, you know, that speaks to broad access to this text. I mean, by 1400, right? Dante dies, what, 1321? We have 300 extant manuscripts. And that's just what has survived, right? So these are being burned out.
Yeah, so that's a 300 has got to be, we have no idea of talent, no way of knowing, but it's got to be a small fraction of...
Exactly. So somebody's reading them.
Right.
You know, I mean, whether they're misreading them, miscopying them, whether they're right or not, whether you're going to argue, but what is the main read, you know, and this is an ongoing argument, what is the main version, or can we even get at the main version? And I think most scholars would say, no, we can't reconstruct that, right? Yeah. And most editions have tended to be based on a particular text, a particular exemplar someone grabs a hold of. But clearly they're being produced in such high numbers, a wide geographical spread. We have, I mean, yeah, that says something about widespread reception, I think. Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly, I don't know, but clearly people are reading it.
Yeah. Well, and people still are, right? I think if a new I'm not sure when the last new translation to English occurred of the comedy, but I could imagine if a new one were to crop up, it could be just as controversial as the latest Odyssey translation. It feels
probably.
Like
probably. You know, that's an interesting question. In dipping into this, you know, I which was fascinating, and there's been an ongoing debate even about the merits of producing these editions. I was thinking of an analogy he used in discussing this when you talked about the restoration of that painting a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
There's a tendency, I think, throughout this discussion to maybe think, my God, this entire centuries-long debate, this massive field of scholarship, is a long argument over spelling.
Right.
But
right.
It's not only about spelling, but even if it was, there's a Dante scholar, Fabio Zanelli, and he points out that this debate, it engages the same kind of concerns about legitimacy as the debates around determining the precise gradations of color when you restore an old master's painting, right? We don't know the exact color of Dante's language. You know, what color was Dante's pen? We don't know. So, and in part, this arises from the positioning of Dante as you know, the progenitor of modern Italian, right? Of a major linguistic and also literary tradition. But he's also a peculiar case because Tuscan is a dialect from which standard Italian first emerged, but it's also remained fairly stable over the centuries. So from what I understand, even though he's a medieval author, his work is still relatively accessible to readers of modern Italian.
Interesting.
Right?
So it wouldn't be like, I know I've read versions of the Canterbury Tales, and parts of the versions that claim to be basically what was written down, right? Obviously errors and things. And it's basically indecipherable to me.
It's tough going, right? Yeah.
Really
tough going. Apparently, and I mean, I'm not a speaker of Italian, but from what I gather, Dante's a little more accessible.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah.
Which is fascinating. So you can understand then why Italian literature and culture, they're not content with just a text from a single regional scribe. They want what is the original?
Yes.
What did he write? I can understand
Right.
the impulse then, because you feel like you almost have a handle on it because it's so accessible. It's not as distant, maybe. I'm speculating here. That said, though, literary history, it's not only about canons or even single versions of canonical texts, and researching how the different readings arise tells us things about the broader history of the comedy and other texts. How is it produced? How is it disseminated? Right? The kind of patterns of transmission we have here. It's the choices people make when they're producing texts. Why do they make them? It's very different
Oh,
choices that they
it's
make.
absolutely fascinating, and it's one way that we can still I think perhaps one of the motivations to get these things right by scholars and by just people who want to read it. I think some of these things are our best way to see those people, in this case, what, 700 years ago, as human beings, we can go back in time. Looking at a artifact tells us some things, but writing and painting, these are the actual manifested thoughts of a human being back then. And I think there's probably a part of us that's like, we want to get it right. We want to be able to see it as clearly as we can. So yeah,
Yeah,
I
doing it kind of honor to him too,
Mm-hmm,
right?
right.
We're
Yeah, you don't want to.
trying to see him. Yeah.
So I admire all the people who have participated in the production of and maintenance of this work.
There have been
It's
so
really amazing,
many, and there still
right?
are. It's
There
an
still
ongoing
are.
concern. It's a very, very active, very rich field. There's a massive amount of scholarship to keep up with if you're going to dip into this. It is fascinating, though. Really interesting. Just a
Yeah,
complete.
well, and thank you. I mean, thank you for bringing the insights and the information that you did, Stephanie. That was fantastic. I feel like
Thank
I
you so much
learned.
for having me. I mean, I'm not a Dante scholar, and I
No,
thought, what the heck?
that's
Nope, I'm
okay.
all
That's
about
okay.
manuscript, though.
Well, Stephanie, as you know from the show, I'm not a scholar in anything in particular. So, a little bit of earnestness and a little bit of due diligence in that, we can at least have a conversation. So that was so great. Thank you so much for your
Absolutely.
time.
Thank you very much. I hope it inspires people to look into things a little bit more deeply and read some Dante.
Yeah, absolutely. Folks who are looking for Stephanie, sure her relevant social media stuff will be in the show notes, and have a good day.